Omaha Public Radio presents another program from the Conoco Great Minds Lecture Series on Noon Forum. We'll hear a talk by Peter Abrahams, Edgar Award-winning author of 35 novels, including boundary-pushing crime novels such as Oblivion, End of Story, and The Fan, the New York Times best-selling laugh-out-loud dog-narrated Chet and Bernie series, written under Mr. Abrahams' pen name, Spencer Quinn, including such titles as Tale of Vengeance, A Fistful of Collars, and The Sound and the Furry, the middle-grade Echo Falls series, including the Agatha Award-winning Down the Rabbit Hole and Into the Dark, and the Bowser and Birdie series, with two titles so far, Woof and Arf. This program, the keynote lecture for the recent storytelling exhibit at the Conoco, was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday evening, July 14, 2016, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the Conoco, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Chris Hochstetler, Executive Director of the Conoco.
I've spent yesterday, last night, and much of this morning with Peter, and I have to tell you, it was an amazing experience, and I know we're going to have an amazing experience tonight with him. He is the kind of guy that you really just want to hang out with and get to know. Just an amazing creative spirit. And I know he's going to share some things with us tonight about creativity and some insights that are going to be very special. Just to share some things about Peter that I know now. He has four children. Incredible family guy. And he spent a lot of years as a diver spearfishing in the Bahamas. I didn't know that. These divers that just hold their breath and they go really deep holding their breath. And to me, that's just amazing. I love that pursuit of athleticism, and that is Peter. He's also a tennis player, an accomplished tennis player. But we're here tonight because he's an incredible storyteller. And the last couple of days, I've gotten a healthy dose of that. He can really tell a story. You all know him from his crime thrillers, perhaps Oblivion, which is a title that he wrote. The Fan, which was made into a movie that starred Robert De Niro. So if you haven't seen that, it's a great movie. Please check it out. Crying Wolf is another one. This Echo Falls mystery series that there are for young adults. My kids just poured over these things. So check those out as well. And then Chet and Bernie. You know, the Chet and Bernie series. What an incredible series. And we had the Humane Society here tonight. And I think they might have already left. I want to send a big shout out. Are they still here? Good, good, good. Humane Society is here. What a perfect place to have a partnership here with the dogs here and Peter, who's going to talk about Chet and Bernie. And it's just fabulous. And as I read the Chet and Bernie series, a few of them, I just want to tell you that I had the aha moment of, that's what my dog is thinking. Because it's a rare talent that could put you in the mind of a dog. It's a true storyteller. And I just want to, I'm not a fan of reading to anybody, but I want to read a phrase to you from Sense and Sensibility that really stuck with me. And this is Chet's view of a person. And just kind of put yourself in the spirit of a dog and listen to what Chet says, because it's quite beautiful what Chet thinks, because he doesn't really ever say anything. Mrs. Parsons' eyes got all far away. Normally, the eyes of old people look just as old as the rest of them, but not always. And Mrs. Parsons belonged to this second group. Her eyes, if you just concentrated on them and screened out the rest of her face, looked kind of young. To me, that phrase just spoke volumes. You know, you can see a dog checking a person out, and that's what he's thinking. You know, so he can really weave a story. And without further ado, I want to introduce Peter Abrahams to all of you, and thank you for coming.
Thank you, Chris, for that really nice introduction, and thank you all for coming, and thanks to Kaneko, too, for everything they've done. I've just enjoyed myself so much so far. Is this microphone too high so that it's kind of obscuring me? It's perfect? Okay. Because they do that deliberately. It's in the contract. Obscure face with microphone. So what's going to happen now is a partially prepared, partially unprepared talk. Here's the prepared part, the first sentence and the last sentence. The first sentence is, where do ideas come from? And the last sentence is, summing up, there is no summing up. So should we stop? Is that enough right there? You get what's going to be in between, right? So a few nights, 3 nights ago, I had this dream. I'd gone back to college, but not as a kid, like as me now. And I was in this little room where me and someone else I knew were looking at these two computer screens, and on it were descriptions of these courses that alumni could take. And so I was reading whatever it was. This is in my dream. And I turned to say to my friend, I think this teacher is going to be black. Only it wasn't my friend anymore. It was a black man. And he said, that's racist. And I said, this is in my dream. No, I'm not. You know, it isn't. And he said, yes, it is. And other people came in the room to also accuse me of this. Okay, so that was the dream. Several days before then, I live on Cape Cod in Massachusetts. We'd had a lot of people over to the house, as you always do on Cape Cod in the summertime. And so we ordered out for Cambodian food. And I was the one who was chosen to go get it. So it's about the Cambodian, yes, Cambodian on Cape Cod. You might not have expected that. So it's about 10 miles away. So I drove, and there was the bags of, the brown bags of Cambodian food, and time to pay. And I noticed, I found that I didn't have my wallet. Now, you're probably saying, what? It's well known that you always leave your wallet in the car, yes. Also, that your car is never locked, and the keys are in it. Okay, that's so where, obviously I'd taken it out for some reason, I didn't remember it, so I couldn't pay. So I said to the woman at the desk, can I come by and pay tomorrow? And she said, I'll have to ask the boss. So she disappeared in the kitchen. Meanwhile, I heard the bartender saying, we've got a lot of dishes. So the door swung open, and out came the boss, who was this Cambodian cook. He took one look at me, went like this, went back into the kitchen. Okay, I've just told these two stories, right? One is the dream, the other is the Cambodian story. Do you sort of sense that those kind of fit together somehow a little bit, or could be made to fit together, or the beginning of something? Maybe they don't fit together perfectly. Maybe they just fit together interestingly, which can be better than perfectly. Okay, so that's the beginning of an idea. Does that make any sense so far? I'm not saying I'll ever do it. It might come to nothing. But Picasso said that the work grows out of the rubbish pile of discarded thoughts. And I agree with that totally. So, but I don't think of it that way. I think it more like in geology. Did anyone take geology in college? Have we got anybody? Okay, so right, please don't correct me. This is going to be all wrong what I'm doing right now. But they have these three kind of rocks. Like they're the igneous rocks, and you know those come out of the fire of the middle of the earth. Then they're the sedimentary rocks that are laid down like in the ocean in layers like this, and those are like sandstone and soft rocks. And then the third kind is the metamorphic, when those sandstones in layers are subjected to great heat and they twist and harden and distort. Okay, I think of what I do as the metamorphic rock approach. All the sandstone that's in layers are your life experiences, your thoughts, your feelings, and then heat has to be applied. And that heat comes from your mind, and that's the force of what turns it into art. Okay, so geology is a very slow process. And so I think that teaches you to be patient in terms of ideas. But now I'm going to switch to something that happened very fast, because that can happen too in this business. One night my wife said to me, you should do something with dogs. Now, I had dogs in my work, my previous work, a lot of times there had been dog characters, but you didn't see from inside the dog. A dog would appear, it might be in for a chapter or two. In fact, Buster in Oblivion, the reviewer for the LA Times said that he was the best. Whoa, I came very close to quoting from my own reviews. I was brought up better than that. But just as an aside, you see it all the time, right? And it, sometimes if you listen closely, you can tell that the reviews they're quoting from aren't even that good. If you listen closely, you can hear the dot, dot, dots going by where they've deleted all the qualifiers in the review. Anyway, forget that. Okay, I do quote from one review. Is there time for a digression before we actually start? None of this will be on the test. I quote from one review. So years ago, I got into writing for kids. Oh, let's back up a little more, and I'll tell you how that happened, and then you'll see more about this process, just by accident. I wrote a book called The Tutor, and for adults, right? This is a dark kind of thriller, suspense novel. And in it, it had to do with this little family in Connecticut that had a teenage son and a 10-year-old daughter. And the teenage son, this was while my own sons were in high school. And I noticed that there's all this fuss and consternation in high school now. Maybe none of you are old enough to have kids, but there's all this fuss and consternation about the SATs. Well, do you remember the SATs? You know what I'm talking about, the SATs? So when I was, you know, my dad dropped me at the high school and I took the SATs and I forgot about it. It was, okay, now it's not like that. There's a lot of stress about it. So I thought, I'm going to write a book, and in this book, the son takes the PSAT, which is the fun test you get to take before the actual SAT, and in it he comes in the 75th percentile. This is in this book, The Tutor. So they're devastated because it means he can't go to Harvard, right? He's better than three-quarters of the people, but that's not good enough. He can't go to Harvard. He'll have to go to the university. It takes place in Connecticut. He'll have to go to UConn, like the state university, which, by the way, the parents went, and they turned out fine. But it's not fine. So they hire this tutor, okay? And these people exist, SAT tutor. It's a business. So they hire this tutor. And this tutor that they hire, his name is Julian. Actually, I modeled a lot of this on Stendhal's The Red and the Black. I took the name Julian right from it. The book sold widely. It was reviewed everywhere. No one spotted that I had done anything like that. So you get a lot of private fun in the writing business. So they hire a tutor, this guy Julian, and he shows up and he's a cultured figure, far more sophisticated, knowledgeable, clever than anybody, than the parents are. And not only does he begin to raise up the scores of this son, you know, the PSAT and the SAT, he finds the weaknesses in all the people in the family that need to be raised up, and he starts fixing them too. Only the 10-year-old girl, Ruby, realizes that they've allowed a monster into their house. So that's The Tutor. An editor at HarperCollins Children's Book read that book, and she said, called my agent, and she said, would he be interested in writing for kids based on the scenes from that character, Ruby, the 10-year-old girl? Well, yeah, I've got four of my own, right? All this raw material was just sitting in my house. So I jumped at it. So the first book I wrote was Down the Rabbit Hole. Chris mentioned this series, the Echo Falls series. And they sent me on tour, and I went into schools all over the place. And the book, it was for 5th through 8th graders, the series. So I was in, somewhere in Illinois, and I went to this school, and a teacher came up to me, and she said, we've got a class of gifted 3rd graders who've read Down the Rabbit Hole. Can they come to your signing? I mean, to the talk. I'm sorry, not the signing. Can they come to the talk? And I said, yeah, because I wanted to see what these gifted 3rd graders looked like. So I gave the talk, and then up come the 5 gifted 3rd graders, tiny figures. I can see them now. And the red-haired one with the freckles and the glasses, he looked up at me and he said, I read your book. It was pretty good. Pretty good is the only review I quote. I want it on my gravestone, and it comes from a certified gifted critic. Not every writer can say that. Okay, that's the only I don't know why we did that digression. That won't count, and but we're in overtime now. You know the way in soccer, there's penalty time, and then they add, and you never know how long it's going to be. Like, this could turn into be like a Godot-like nightmare. But so my wife said, in less time than it took me to just to do that, my wife said, you should do something with dogs. And, you know, sometimes in this business, things can go very fast. So, in 30 seconds, 6 months worth of work can happen. But the reverse is true as well. So in 30 seconds, I knew if the Chet and Bernie series can be said to work, I knew the three things that were going to make it work in 30 seconds. I wanted to write stories that were narrated by a dog. I wanted those stories to be traditional private eye detective novels where the sidekick tells the stories in the first person. That form goes all the way back to Sherlock Holmes and Dr. Watson. Third, and this is the most important thing, this dog was a narrating dog, not a talking dog. This dog did not talk. It looked like this dog was going to look like any other dog. It was not a human dressed up in a canine suit. This dog would not know anything it shouldn't know. So we live on Cape Cod. We have a house and overlooking a salt marsh, and there's a detached garage, and above it is my room. And I left the house at that moment. I went over to my office. It's a 15-foot commute, but important psychologically. I went over to the house, and I wrote the first page of what became Doggone It. And where Chet is the dog and Bernie is the detective, I found those names right away, which is a real good sign. I can't write a character unless I have the name. And in 20 minutes, I had the name in the first page of Doggone It. So I took it back, and my wife read it over, and we voted 2-0 that it worked. Well, no, a really good thing that none of the kids were home, because we could have lost 4-2, and there'd be no Chet and Bernie. And some of my kids are very tough. I'll just do another digression, then we'll get back to the talk. I wrote a book called End of Story once, which actually Steve King told me. He said, this is like a handbook for how to write a crime novel. And crazily enough, that's exactly what I'd intended, but I never dared say it. Anyway, the story is about this young woman with an MFA degree who wants to be a writer, and she's working in a bar. She gets a job teaching inmates at an upstate prison in New York how to write. They have programs like that. In this prison program, she encounters this inmate whose writing is brilliant. It's star quality. She's just bowled over by it. And she can't reconcile the quality of that art with the horrible crime that he was not only convicted of, but pleaded guilty to. So she begins to investigate the crime. So I was just telling you about my children and how some can be tough. So my youngest daughter, Rosie, who's now a political reporter for BuzzFeed, she was about 12 years old at the time, and I told her just what I told you, and she said, but Dad, that means you're going to have to produce a sample of this guy's brilliant writing. So forget it. So, you know, I knew that I was going to have to do that, but my mother taught me how to write when I was a little boy, and one of the things she told me is when you get a good idea, dig out that mind fully. Don't just take the first few nuggets. Exploit it completely. So I knew that not only was I going to have to reproduce the brilliant writing, but that brilliant writing couldn't exist merely as a sample of brilliant writing. It had to advance the story as well, sneakily, and I knew that in that brilliant writing, the secret of what he had really done had to be revealed in there, but Ivy, the woman, won't understand it till later. So even though my daughter Rosie told me not to do it, I went ahead and wrote the book anyway. Okay, so back to Doggone It. So I wrote the first page, and this whole series has happened, and here's the thing. The plotting of a mystery novel is very like the solving of a real crime. Mystery writers have feasted off, you know, that fact forever. So, and the solving of a real crime, the writing of a mystery novel, is you gather up a lot of clues, you put them in some sort of logical order and you reach a solution, right? Well, Chet can't do that. And even if he could, when an important clue was about to be revealed, he might sniff a Cheeto under a sofa and he misses it. So he's an unreliable narrator, which you have to go to graduate school to learn how to do, and which I didn't do. But a funny thing happens. You see, you don't know what you know. That's the funny thing about writing. I didn't realize that when you married the unreliable narrator to this rather strict form, the plotting of a mystery novel, all of a sudden everything was up in the air. It was all fair game, and you were doing something new, which I love to do. The other thing that's interesting about it that I only discovered in the doing was that in terms of the senses, it's totally different. See, we naturally, vision is our big sense, our go-to sense, and the others are puny, as Chet often remarks. He doesn't understand why, you know, there are powerful odors in the air and no one's picking it up, even though their noses are big. He doesn't know what they're for. So this book, this series is primarily a series that's related through sense of hearing and sense of smell, which are the big ones for a dog. So it was, from the get-go, a very different kind of thing. Okay, so people say, well, how much of this is planned out? That's the tough question. I don't really, sometimes not a whole hell of a lot. For example, after Doggone It came out, I think after Thereby Hangs a Tale, my editor called me and he said, you know, we had a meeting today and somebody said, have you noticed that all the descriptions are from this level, not this level? Did he do that deliberately? So my editor got on the phone and he called me and he repeated that question, and that's the first I'd heard of it. Yeah, it's right, but I hadn't done any research into that at all. I hadn't thought it out. I didn't sit down and say, okay, every scene has to be like this, and this is what has to be done, and this can't be done. I don't work at all that way. One of the things that happened that was really nice, but at the start terrified me, they said, would you be willing to do social media? This is back in 2008. So after they explained what that was, I said I'd take a swing at it. And so Chet has a blog, and he's on Facebook, and all of a sudden, people, right away, people began to come to these areas, and they were sending in photos of their dogs. So on chetthedog.com, I think there were over 3,000 before we had a crash and lost most of them. But on Facebook, there's still, I think, 2,000, I mean, or something like that. And it grows all the time. So I said, look, we've got to do something about all these dogs, well, not just dogs, cats, gerbils, hamsters, stuffed animals with names, yes, from adults. And so I said we should do something like where there's some kind of drawing. And so once a month, there's a random number generator picks the friend of the month. And that animal is displayed for the full month on the page. And the human companion gets a signed and paw printed copy of the latest book. And a random number generator picks it. But now I'm going to tell you a secret. Okay, this can't go beyond these four walls. Right? If I'm at an event like this and afterwards I'm signing books or something and someone comes up and tells me about, you know, their little boxer Duke puppy named Duke or something like that, well, I see all these pictures coming in and a thumb can be put on the scale. Okay? All right, you didn't hear it here. I think what I should do now, for people who don't know the series, is it okay if I read a tiny bit just so you'll see how this works? Okay, it'll be over. It's just a 40 or 50-page excerpt, and I'll make quick work of it. Just because if you don't know, I hope I mark this. I'm not that good a reader, although I always thought I was. But when you hear the reader who does these on audio, Jim Frangione, he's just brilliant. So I'll read this. There's some names that come up here. You know, I mean, you won't know who they are because it's in the middle of the book, but it doesn't matter. One of the things that this scene exploits, though, is something that I think is very true, and that is that people talk to their dogs. And they almost always tell the truth, because why would you lie to your dog. So I'll just read this little scene. They're trying to solve a case. They're out in the desert, the two of them sitting in the Porsche. It's a very old and beaten up Porsche. Remember, this is Chet's point of view. It's all in the first person, Chet's point of view. I sat very still, eyes on Bernie, listening my very best. This was not easy to understand, and now there was going to be more? And then, listening my very best, I picked up the sound of distant barking, very faint, but not so faint that I wouldn't have bet dollars to donuts, if that means you end up with donuts, on it being distant barking of the she-barking kind, which made concentrating on what Bernie had to say even more of a challenge. We could go back out to the desert, Bernie said, hunt for more missing cactuses, get a bead on who's digging them up. Or we could talk to some biker pals, take a swing at seeing where D Branch might be hanging out. Then there's the obvious route of hitting all the musclehead gyms for leads on the Fu Manchu twins. People tend to remember twins, especially twins who look like those two. There's also Garwood Mickles, the nephew, over at Indian Hills Precinct. We could even take a chance, try a direct route, get into a pissing contest with Brick himself, or... But don't rely on me for what came after. Because pissing contest? There were pissing contests in this life? How is it possible that I'd reached my age, whatever it happened to be exactly, without knowing about them? I knew about all kinds of competition, like baseball, football, basketball, lacrosse, great balls, each and every one. Lacrosse balls being my favorite, just a wonderful springy resistance when you're chewing on them, as well as boxing, wrestling, and even hockey, where I'd gotten onto the ice once, the slipperiness of ice being the biggest surprise in a night of surprises, and actually tasted puck. Very odd. Kind of like tires, but forget all that. What I'm getting at is that I'd never once encountered a pissing contest. How crazy was that? Especially since, and this is the whole point, who was going to beat me in a pissing contest? Go ahead, name anybody, and I'll take them on. Two at a time. More than two, I was born for pissing contests. Pissing contests were my, how would you put it, calling? Yes, that was it. Pissing contests were my calling. So why had I been kept away from them? I had a thought I'd never had before and hope I never have in life again. Life was unfair. So, thank you. So, that's kind of the way it works. That's what I just did is kind of like a monologue. They go back to Shakespeare. Hamlet would turn to the audience and do that kind of thing. This is just my, a dog's version of that. I mentioned that my mother taught me how to write, and do you want me to go into that for a brief second, or is it time for the banjo and the tap dancing now? This is pretty unusual because it happened so young. You know, do you think, like, some of the most important things we learn in life we don't remember? Like, when we learned how to talk, when we learned how to walk, these are huge, and you can't remember how you did it, even learning how to read. Well, I was a little older than that when my mom taught me. My mom was a writer, too. And she taught me, I'm so lucky because I was young, and I don't even know how much I was born with and how much she gave me. I went to a school where there was lots of writing. This is before the SATs. Not really. The SATs weren't important, but this is before the five-paragraph essay that we now torment our kids with. You know the five-paragraph essay? It's this fascistic form of writing that they make you fit into this box. But I wasn't required to do that. I could write, in my class, we could write whatever we wanted. I liked adventure stories like Treasure Island, so every week I turned in an adventure story as close to Treasure Island as I could get. Out of all those reams of stories, I can remember only how one began. The archaic telephone jangled shrilly in the murky tropical night. The archaic telephone jangled shrilly in the murky tropical night. That was followed by 5 pages of an incomprehensible adventure in the Amazon jungle, to which I'd been no closer than the local zoo in Boston. But my mom would look at that and she'd say, okay, the archaic telephone jangled shrilly in the murky tropical night. Doesn't jangled mean shrilly? Yeah, Mom. Well, do you need shrilly? No. To this day, very few adverbs in my work. The noun and the verb are like the mummy and the daddy, and I want to just put this in a nice way, you pound them together, and that's the strength of your prose. Then she'd say, okay, the archaic telephone, is archaic the right word here? No, it's just agonizingly close. She'd never tell me. She hated connecting words. If you're a reader, still a reader of the New York Times, you know that there's a plague of connecting words like to be sure, nevertheless, however, a contagion going from one reporter to another right now. I guess there's no editor left to stop it. But my mom said to me, the sentences should connect through the force of the ideas connecting. And if you find yourself using a lot of connecting words, re-examine your ideas. She would say, okay, where's a better place to put this word? What's the exact right word? Can you say this in fewer words? Can you make this sentence do more than just working on the character? Can it do the plot, something about the plot too? I mean, this is gold, right, for a writer, and I had it when I was a boy. So, and she didn't stop there. She worked on the imagination too, which I think everybody could understand. You could be taught the toolkit. But the imagination part, like we were talking about before, when I started with that dream, that unpleasant dream, and then the very nice thing at the Cambodian restaurant, okay, and then the imagination to work. Well, she taught me, you know, how to never do boilerplate, bend every note, and push those ideas as far as you can. You know, and let someone else tell you that you've gone too far. Don't you be the one to put your own brakes on. So she died before I became a writer, actually, so she never knew this. Actually, my dad told me something funny a couple of years ago. My dad's still alive. He's 92 in unbelievable health. So he said, this is about 2 years ago, he said, hey, Pete, did I ever tell you when your mom decided that maybe you could be a writer? And I said, no, Dad, what are we waiting for? He said, okay, so I quoted from my own reviews. Now I'm going to do something even worse than that. I'm going to tell a cute toddler story about myself. This was in preschool. I was in a preschool where every day we went for a walk. But on this particular day, it was raining outside, so we couldn't go outside, but we still went for the walk, but it was an imaginary walk. Well, I mean, we were walking, but the scenery inside was imaginary. Like the teacher would say, okay, now here's a stop sign, and we'd all clomp to a stop. Do you see what I'm saying, kind of? Imaginary walk indoors, but there's scenery that the teacher's describing. So we're walking, and she said, okay, class, here's a puddle. So everybody in the class walked around the puddle except for me. I went right through the puddle. And the teacher said, Petey, what about the puddle? And I said, I've got boots on. So when my mom came to get me, the teacher told her this story. And my mom knew she had the makings of the writer. She, self-absorbed, attention-seeking, and a troublemaker. Those are the three pillars upon which you build a writing career. The rest is polish, and anyone can do it. I just, one thing more on the social media, because the second nicest thing that ever happened in my career happened because of social media. Over at Chet's blog, all this sort of community of people have come together, and a subgroup of them, one day they, you know these quilts? Well, here's an art thing right here. You know these quilts where, you'll all know this, where one person makes one part and a patch and another. Okay, without letting me know, this group of people made a huge patchwork quilt all about the Chet and Bernie series, and one day it just showed up at my door. So it hangs in a place of pride in my office. So this series has affected so many people. I get, well, for example, Sense and Sensibility was the last book, and there's no more Chet and Bernie scheduled. Every day, in one form or another, I'm getting emails in all caps all the time. You know, is Bernie going to live? What? Okay, I can assure you he is. I've written something else that I'll go into at the very end. And we're almost, don't worry, we're almost at the very end. But there will be more of Chet and Bernie, and Bernie's fine. But people, I hear all the time that when I was going through a rough time, I read these books and they really helped me. And I never said, that's humbling, I never set out to do that. But I kind of think it has something to do with this, and I didn't also, this is another thing I knew but didn't know I knew when I started the series. These aren't cozy mysteries, you know, those kind of light English village vicar type. These are much darker than that. Chet feels, you know, suffers at times, and he's maltreated, and things like that happen. But he has a way of bouncing back to his reset position very quickly. And that reset position is one of joy in life, and I think something about that appeals to people. The other thing is it has to do with the spirit of the book. Now, a lot of books don't have a spirit, unfortunately. In the mystery world, in the totem pole of mystery, at the bottom are the ones that just have a great plot. And if you don't have that, you're dead in mystery, because a huge percentage of the readers of mystery and crime fiction, that's all they want. Well, that's never enough. So at the bottom is just a great plot with lots of twists and turns, and believe me, those are not easy to do. And then up a little higher, you start to get better characterization, and you get mood and tone and better prose. But at the top, you get two things. One is thematic material. I didn't figure out how to do thematic material. As in that book, End of Story, that I described, you can right away see that there's going to be thematic material there. That it's about something. It's not just an adventure. It's about something. Until my sixth book, Lights Out. But the other thing you get is a spirit of the book. The engine that makes the story go. So I was at the Tucson Book Festival a few years ago. It's a great festival, by the way. And with two other writers were sitting up on stools. And somebody in the audience said, what about writer's block? And I said, I never get it. I mean, I knocked on wood, but I never get it. And the two writers looked at me aghast. You know, how's that possible? And I said, whenever I feel that I'm not sure where I'm going, I step back and I think of the engine that drives the story, the beating heart of the story, and then some narrative route suggests itself. Well, the beating heart of the story, what drives it in the Chet and Bernie novels, is the love between Chet and Bernie. All I have to do is think, you know, step back, and I have that. And I think that's really the thing that people relate to in the series. So I told you the second best thing to have in my career. Do you want to go on to the best one, or should we just... Because normally when I say that and no one puts up their hand, what was the best, I don't do it. So we'll stick with that. I won't do it. But we'll skip that. So that'll be a secret for later. No, you really? Because I don't want to run over on time here. Michael, how are we? Where's Michael? Are we good? You're sure? I don't want to get to the stage where they're throwing things at me, because that's my metric for when the talk isn't working. Okay, here's the best thing. I love writing for kids. And I didn't realize it until I started. So this new series I'm doing, the Bowser and Birdie, is just because you hear from you hear from kids, right? And they're unmediated in what they say. For example, after Down the Rabbit Hole, I get emails like the one I'm going to tell you now all the time, but this one was perfect. So after Down the Rabbit Hole came out, I got the following email. I know it word for word. I have to do a report on your book, Down the Rabbit Hole. Please tell me the story in your own words. So, I mean, it couldn't be better. So what I've done, actually, on the website, I've written a special thing for kids, because I know they're coming there to get material for their term papers, and I give them a thing I wrote a thing telling them why I won't do that, but at the same time, I kind of give them a little help. But the best thing that happened in my career had to do with this, too. So they send you into the schools. Now, I haven't done it recently, but I've done a lot in the past. So, you know, usually there are schools in very upscale places because those are the kids who have the money to buy the books. And after the first year when I saw that, I said, okay, next year I want to go to some not so upscale, even if we, you know, don't sell as many books, because what are we doing here, you know? So anyway, I was in Chicago. Oh, yeah, okay, this was in a very nice suburb of Chicago, so it was a very good school. You know, I mean, just like, it was a public school, I think, but just like a private school. And so after, you know, we went to the bookstore, which is a beautiful bookstore, one of the best in the country. And they were setting me up at a little table at the front, and they were bringing the books where I was going to have the signing. So I'd done the talk, and now was the signing. It was near the school. So they're setting me up, and no one's really in the store. I'm alone at the table. The staff is somewhere else. And all of a sudden, the door opens, and in comes 7 or 8, you know, dark-skinned boys, African-American boys, or mixed, and kind of, you know, broad-shouldering their way around the store. And you could kind of tell they hadn't been in bookstores, and the bookstore people didn't know what to make of them. And all of a sudden, they surrounded my table. And I looked up, they looked down. And out from behind stepped this man, and he said, I'm a priest who runs an after-school program in Racine, Wisconsin. We read down the rabbit hole in our program. We saw in the paper that you were going to be here, and we rented a bus to come down and see you. That's the best thing that ever happened in my career. Because, no, you, okay, so, my God, I did the talk again. I said, you should have let me know. You could have come to this school. But I just did the whole thing again. I signed their books, they left, and that was that. But if something like that happens, every career has stress, of course, but you forget the whole thing, right? I mean, that's like you got touched by something good, and it's good. Okay, so if Chet and Bernie isn't the next thing that's coming, what's coming? There's a third book in the Bowser and Birdie series called, Woof, Arf, and this one is Bow Wow. I had some creative input in that, not much. But that's coming out next April. But meanwhile, I wrote a book called The Right Side that's, I don't think it's even a crime book. It's a straight novel, and it's about a horribly wounded female vet who comes back from Afghanistan and what happens after that. So she's lost an eye, and this half of her face is horribly scarred, but she was a beauty. So that if you now came into a bar and she was sitting at the end facing you this way, you know, sideways, you know, men of a certain type would try to pick her up. And of course, a scene like that happens in it. So it starts in Walter Reed Army Medical Center, and she meets this other female vet who's also badly wounded, and they form a brief but intense relationship. This, our woman, Leanne, it's not just physical. There's mental and emotional, and she's got terrible. Her mind is not there. She's not what she used to be, and she used to be a star in every way, and a wonderful person in many ways, too, as you see in some flashbacks. So she and Marcy, this wounded woman, are sharing a room, and they form this intense relationship. And then, I'll give a little spoiler, Marcy dies unexpectedly, suddenly. And Leanne, wearing Marcy's red shoes, just leaves the hospital, doesn't even sign out, and she leaves and tries to hook up with her old life in America, and it's a shambles. She's a violent, difficult person now, and it's impossible. She ends up, Marcy had told her where Marcy lives. It's in Washington, state of Washington. She ends up, and there's a dog in this, by the way, but not a narrating dog, and the dog appears in a supporting role in all senses of the word, but about two-thirds of the way through the book, and no narration from the dog. The dog doesn't even have a name at first. And she ends up in Marcy's town. And suddenly, as I was writing this, Leanne began to slide into the life that Marcy left behind. Her old boyfriend and all this stuff that actually really bothered me. And I thought, wow, why is this happening and what should I do about it? So where did the idea come from? That it's almost like if you've seen Ingmar Bergman's movie Persona, it's almost like the end of that. Where did that come from? Where did that idea come from? So, summing up, there's no summing up. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you. So I'm happy to take any questions, right? Is that,
yep.
Am I right, Michael, or have
Absolutely.
I messed it all up?
You're right. And I've got a microphone here, so if you'll raise your hand, I'll run it on up to you.
Hi.
Hi.
I've been a longtime fan.
There
will be a couple of nights during a year's time when I don't have a nightmare related to events either in hard rain or pressure drop. And I'm wondering if you've been optioned for... I just don't understand why those two novels haven't been made into movies and if people approach you about that.
These are very early novels that I wrote, Hard Rain and Pressure Drop. I think Hard Rain might have been my third or fourth book. It was optioned by people in Hollywood for many, many years, and Pressure Drop was too. I've had maybe a dozen books option. Only one got made, which was The Fan, you know, with I can't answer those questions. I can't speak for those people, but I will tell you a little story. But again, this is a secret, okay? Because this would be the end of my Hollywood career. So the Chet and Bernie series have been optioned since before Doggone It came out, continuously. Universal had it, and so fine, but nothing was happening. And so finally my agent out there sent me a screenplay to read. So I read the screenplay. Okay, so you know the book. Chet narrates, right? So how are you going to handle that in a movie? Okay, here's how they handled it. Bernie gets hit on the head, and after that, he can hear Chet. Okay, so that's the answer to your question. Yeah. I only had one idea about the movie. I said that there should be one of these nationwide contests to find the dog that plays Chet. That was. Remember, they used to have these nationwide contests? Were there other questions?
The question is, how did you decide on the name Spencer Quinn for the Chet and Bernie series?
Okay, so when I sent in Doggone It, remember my wife and I had the conversation, I wrote the first page, and it took me maybe 3 or 4 months to write that book. And I sent it in to my agent. I've had the same agent for a long time, which is really important in this career. And she read it, and she loved it, and she said, you know, I'm not saying your other writing isn't funny, Pete. Because it is, but colder, wouldn't you admit? She was just edging up on me. So I think this is warmer. And after all, it is in the first person. You've never done that before. And it's narrated by a doc. I'm worried that we won't find the audience that I know is out there for this. So I think we should have a pen name. So the next thing I knew, she and my wife had come up with Spencer Quinn. I don't know why. But I'm out of a lot of loops in my family, and I just, so I thought, okay, I'm going to be two people. So you ended up with Peter Abrahams tonight, which is too bad, by the way, because Spencer Quinn is a way better talker. Were there others? Well then, well, thank you all very much for coming. I appreciate it.
You've been listening to a program from the Kaneko Great Minds Lecture Series on Noon Forum. On today's program, we've heard a talk by Peter Abrahams, Edgar Award-winning author of 35 novels, including boundary-pushing crime novels such as Oblivion, End of Story, and The Fan, the New York Times best-selling laugh-out-loud dog-narrated Chet and Bernie series written under Mr. Abrahams' pen name, Spencer Quinn, including such titles as Tale of Vengeance, A Fistful of Collars, and The Sound and the Furry. The middle grade Echo Falls series, including the Agatha Award-winning Down the Rabbit Hole and Into the Dark. And the Bowser and Birdie series, with two titles so far, Woof and Arf. This program, the keynote lecture for the recent storytelling exhibit at the Kaneko, was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday evening, July 14, 2016, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Michael Hollins, Director of Programming at Kaneko, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 600 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.